Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. The oil and gas boom of the 21st century has been fueled largely by a technique called hydraulic fracturing. It's given access to massive shale gas and oil formations in states like Texas, Colorado, North Dakota, and Pennsylvania. But what's different about this boom is that drilling is bumping right up against communities, and people are worried about the health impacts. The industry has taken off so quickly that scientific research about those impacts is playing catch-up. For Inside Energy, Jordan Werfsbrock and Lee Patterson report.
When it comes to the health impacts of oil and gas development, not just fracking, but all the traffic, noise, and air pollution that goes along with it, why is there so much confusing information out there? I'm Jordan Werfsbrock in Colorado.
And I'm Lee Patterson in Wyoming. After spending hours chatting with scientists in the field, we found one of the biggest challenges in researching these health risks is, you guessed it,
there's not a lot of funding.
You know, funding is absolutely a challenge.
There's time involved to go out and get funding.
Funding is always in short supply, but for people who study something as controversial as oil and gas drilling, they also have to worry about where the money comes from.
Hello, this is Nadia.
I reached Nadia Steinzer at her office in upstate New York. She's a health researcher at an advocacy group called Earthworks.
You know, I suppose academic institutions face a huge challenge of not becoming what's been coined recently as fracademia.
That's a clever but not so nice name for researchers whose work is paid for by the oil and gas industry. Scientists who study this topic are hyper aware of their reputations. John Adgate is with the Colorado School of Public Health. His work is not paid for by the industry, and he has basically read every one of the hundreds of studies on this subject. I asked him what it's like to work on something so controversial.
It poses lots of challenges, and you're right, I don't want to elaborate a lot on that.
And here's a few other challenges. To study the real impacts of drilling, you kind of need to know what your air and water quality looked like before the well went in. Scientists call this baseline testing. And because we don't have a time machine, it's hard to understand the effects of drilling without having done these tests first.
And pollutants don't affect everyone the same way. To study, say, birth defects in babies born near drill sites, you would need to have a lot of information about the mother. John Adgate again.
Things about their diet and their prenatal care and all sorts of other stuff.
For researchers, understanding these risks requires being a little bit of a stalker.
The unsexy part of public health is following people over time. It's called tracking, or sometimes it's a little more creepily called surveillance.
This type of surveillance can take years, and it's a necessary step in figuring out exposure.
In other words, how much of the risky stuff that we know is in the air and water is actually getting into someone's body. To do this, researchers measure dust or a toxin like benzene at a work site and figure out how far it can travel. All of this is hard work.
So you need knowledge about what's going on at the well pad. You need access.
Which means getting the drilling companies to cooperate. Not always easy.
You need to have a lot of relatively expensive equipment arrayed around the site.
And there's not just one source of risk. There's an entire drilling infrastructure. Trucks, pipelines, condenser tanks, dusty roads, plus everyday pollution, which makes it hard to figure out the relationship between a risk and an actual health problem.
So just because two things happen at the same time, like a child living near a natural gas well and getting respiratory problems, doesn't mean one caused the other, although it could have.
But researchers are making progress, and we actually know a lot, just not enough.
It's a field where you're trying to keep people out of the hospital. So, I mean, public health is all about prevention. This is, from a research standpoint, a really challenging problem.
In part two of this series, we'll go over what we know about how drilling can affect your health, along with what we don't know, and how researchers are working to fill in those gaps. For Inside Energy, I'm Jordan Werfsbrock.
And I'm Lee Patterson.
There's a huge, mostly invisible web of pipelines crisscrossing the country that make it possible for our stoves to light and our cars to turn on. Those pipelines run from oil and gas-producing regions to refineries and processing plants, crossing miles of private property along the way. The people whose land they cross don't often benefit. But as Wyoming Public Radio Stephanie Joyce reports in part four of our series on pipelines, a new strategy may help.
Driving across parts of Rocky Foy's property is like being on a roller coaster.
See, here's another one, another one, another one, another one.
There are 12 pipelines that cross Foy's cattle ranch outside of Glendoe. The gravel road rises over each one of them, then drops back down. As we bump along, Foy jokes.
The only lottery I ever won in my life is all the pipelines.
It's a lottery he wishes he hadn't won, and one he didn't choose to enter. In Wyoming, as in most states, pipelines have the power of eminent domain, which means they can cross private property with or without the owner's permission, so long as the companies offer reasonable compensation.
First line came in, I think Grandpa said, 1927.
The compensation for that line?
Grandpa let them come across for basically nothing. He sold them beef every day because they had to stay on the line.
Foy no longer accepts beef purchases as payment, but he says it can be hard to negotiate good deals as a single landowner up against a billion-dollar company.
They come and they pick you off one by one, you know.
But things were different with pipeline number 12, the pipeline that's currently being laid on his property. When Oklahoma-based Highland Partners said they'd take Foy to court if he didn't sign an agreement with the company for its Double H crude pipeline from North Dakota to Guernsey, Foy joined a group of landowners to negotiate.
And then it gave us so much more clout because we had one voice rather than, you know, 200 small voices or whatever.
As simple as it sounds, collective bargaining was a novel approach. Attorney Frank Fallon, who represented the group, says banding together wasn't easy, in part because of the pipeline company.
They deliberately made it very difficult as possible for the landowners who were trying to figure out who else was going to be impacted.
Highland didn't respond to interview requests, but Fallon says the company was obviously nervous that the landowners were banding together to oppose the pipeline. But he says that was never the goal. The goal was to get better terms.
The landowner does not get to share in the profits of this, but they absolutely get to share in the problems and in the risk.
Risks that range from the obvious, like fires and spills, to the less expected. Foy, the rancher, tells a story of shooting at a coyote once and accidentally hitting a natural gas pipeline on his property.
And that sounded like you were standing behind a jet taking off. It was just roaring.
But Foy was lucky.
It scared the coyote, and it scared me, but it didn't blow up.
That pipeline has been on Foy's property for 30 or 40 years. Foy says the contract he signed is maybe a couple pages long and doesn't address what happens if, say, the pipeline gets shot or if the company decides to abandon it. That's in stark contrast with the latest agreement for the Double H pipeline. Foy says by banding together, the landowners group was able to get Highland's attention.
It got to the point to where the CEO of Highland was getting some of his guys and their corporate lawyer and getting on their jet and flying up and talking.
Foy guesses the final contract, including appendices, is over 70 pages long. It touches on everything from reclamation of the land to gates that need to be shut.
There's no gray area. Everything has been discussed and it's all spelled out on paper.
And the payment? 6 times the original offer. To say Foy is happy about the contract would be too strong. He'd prefer not dealing with pipelines at all. But he knows that's wishful thinking.
Once you get a pipeline corridor started on you, I mean, I just can't foresee it ever stopping until we find a different source of energy.
By one estimate, 500,000 miles of pipeline will be built in the U.S. over the next 2 decades. The Double H isn't even in the ground, and Foy says another company has already contacted him to let him know they're thinking about running a pipeline across his property. But this time, Foy knows that he won't be negotiating alone. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
When we come back, we will hear about armored vehicles in Cheyenne and listen to a Holocaust survivor. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. One of the most riveting images that has emerged out of the protests in Ferguson, Missouri, is of civilian police officers using military vehicles for crowd control. For years, the Department of Defense has distributed equipment and vehicles to law enforcement offices all across the country, including some in Wyoming. WPR's Miles Bryant rode along with the Cheyenne SWAT team as they trained with their new military vehicle and filed this report.
The Cheyenne PD's new mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle, or MRAP, is about the size of a city garbage truck, but it seems much bigger than that. It's all angles, jutting armor and massive shocks, and its tires look like they could crush my old sedan without much of a problem. It's also very loud. The vehicle was built for combat in Kabul or Fallujah, not for the streets of Cheyenne, and that makes it a little tough to drive here, as the officer in training is finding out.
Clear right?
No, you need to look at your mirrors. Check all your mirrors.
I got
a... The guy giving directions is SWAT team leader Lieutenant Terrence Bell. He wants to show me why acquiring an MRAP was necessary. We start with the department's old armored vehicle.
So this is the old Peacekeeper. This is one of the first vehicles that they used that was made of armor. See how much smaller it is?
That vehicle is half the size, has less armor, and is 30 years older than the MRAP. Bell also points out that it has something the MRAP doesn't have, weapon mounts.
You have your portals, which you can shoot out of. You have your turret, which has the mount to mount a weapon. This is more of a fighting vehicle.
When Bell and his team set out to replace their old armored vehicle last year, they went to a Department of Defense program that distributes surplus military vehicles to police departments for cheap. Like, really cheap.
So you spent $1,800...
to get a $733,000 vehicle.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Bell says that without the DOD program, his department would have had to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on a civilian armored vehicle. And even though Cheyenne's SWAT team doesn't plan on using its MRAP often, there are situations when it would be crucial. Bell offered the example of a time 8 years ago when a guy barricaded himself in a Cheyenne firehouse and threatened to blow up its propane tanks.
That would have been a perfect situation for this. We could have gotten close to the situation, and even if the propane tank had gone off, we would still be safe.
But what about the fact that seeing a vehicle made for war in the Middle East parked on the curb is scary for a lot of people? Bell says he understands the concerns, but thinks they're unfounded.
Problem is, nobody comes out and looks at it. And when I pointed out, look, I couldn't shoot you from this vehicle if I wanted to. All the rules as per the Constitution, as per the state law, federal law, all still apply. I don't get to run over you just because I have this vehicle. This vehicle just allows me to not get shot.
Bell drew an analogy to firefighters. We wouldn't send them to fight a fire without all the equipment they might need, he said. So why would we deny cops, who also risk their lives, any equipment they might possibly need?
I don't think you can compare it to firemen. Firemen don't scare me. Firemen are there to help me. In these situations, police have given the expectation that they're not there to help.
Linda Burt is the director of Wyoming's ACLU. While these military vehicles are usually reserved for SWAT teams, Burt points to a study from the National ACLU that says 62% of the time SWAT teams are deployed, it's for simple drug warrants. Wyoming currently does not have explicit regulations as to how MRAPs can and can't be used. Cheyenne's PD relies on a subjective risk matrix and does not publicly report instances when armored vehicles are used. Burt says the police do have a right to protect themselves.
But the individuals and citizens also have a right to be protected from police and from any kind of excessive violence or excessive use of this equipment.
The Paramount Cafe is a local spot in downtown Cheyenne. I asked Lou Christo, a truck driver, what he thought about his city's police force getting military armored vehicles as he was walking past.
I think it's good for them. I mean, you got drug dealers and criminals that are, well, outmanned and outgunned the police. And anything we can do to support them, I believe is a good thing.
Amy Larson is another passerby, and her position is a little more complicated. Her dad and her boyfriend are cops. She says, of course she wants them to be safe, but having police share so much with soldiers perpetuates a destructive cycle.
If police are treating citizens like enemies that they would in a war zone, it kind of makes the citizens respond as if the police were an enemy that they would find in a war zone.
It remains to be seen how law enforcement agencies in Wyoming will use their military vehicles. Lieutenant Bell says his team is still working on driver's training. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Miles Bryan.
On August 28th, Eva Schloss, who's the stepsister and childhood friend of Anne Frank, will give a talk about her time in Auschwitz during the Holocaust. She will appear at the Center for the Arts in Jackson at 7 that evening at an event hosted by the Chabad Jewish Center of Wyoming. She tells me how she met Anne Frank.
Well, we a Jewish family in Vienna, in Austria, and when Hitler came, of course, life became unbearable for Jewish people and dangerous. So we were very lucky to get out of the country, and eventually we were able to find refuge in Amsterdam. And we moved to a big square where some other refugees from Germany had moved, and I was 11 years old, and so was Anne Frank. And one day this little girl came to me and heard that I was new in the country, and she introduced herself and told me that her family came from Germany, and she took me to her apartment to meet her family, who were able to speak German with me, because at the time I didn't speak hardly any Dutch.
Mm-hmm.
So that is how I met her family, and this is how I met Anne. And then regularly after school, all the kids came out, and we all played together. Then after we were there several months, the Germans invaded Holland as well, and so things became difficult again for Jewish people. And then after a time, we went into hiding, like the Frank family. And after 2 years in hiding, we were captured and sent to Auschwitz.
How often does that still haunt you to this day?
It's very, very clear. It's like an image in front of me all the time. But, you know, I must admit, it's not so painful anymore. For years and years, I had nightmare and I was miserable and so on. But, you know, it's after all 70 years ago, and that's a long time. The only thing that I never got over was the loss of my father and brother, because that meant that our life was never the same anymore.
I'm curious your thoughts on how that story has been told. Obviously, Hollywood has tried to take some big looks at it. There's been a lot of documentaries. Do you think that the story has been told accurately?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. There are many films made. Some are not according to what really happened. For instance, I don't know if you've seen that in America, The Boy in the Striped Pyjama.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of that movie?
Yes.
I mean, this is completely ridiculous. Nothing like this could have ever happened. But then there is a wonderful film, The Pianist,
mm-hmm.
which is, I think, very, very accurate. And, you know, I mean, there are many, like you say, many films, and some are better than others.
You're very familiar with all of them, and you're very familiar, I'm sure, with a lot of books that have been written on this subject. Are you able to even go back and read them and watch the films without, you know, some sort of trauma?
Well, Schindler's List I've never seen, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read several books, but not history about it, not really case books, because I find that too upsetting. I'm very interested in the history, even from Nazis, you know, why they did it, and if they're sorry and all kinds, you know, more reflection about this period.
And obviously you've been very successful, and you've moved forward as best you possibly can. And I know when you're going to be in Wyoming, you're going to talk a little bit about what we have learned from the past and maybe what we have to look forward to in the future. I mean, what are some things that are going on today that, you know, we need to be paying very close attention to, do you think?
Yeah, well, what's going on today, I'm afraid I'm very, very upset, because it looks as if people haven't learned anything, you know, what's going on in Syria and Iraq and in Africa, that people still hate each other so much that they're willing to kill each other just because they think different or have a slightly different religion. And this is really what happened with Hitler. He just wanted to eliminate all the Jewish people just because they were Jews. So, you know, unfortunately, nothing really much has changed. And that is really very, very disappointing, because after the war, everybody really said, never again Auschwitz, we have learned our lesson, and now we are going to live in harmony together. Well, it was perhaps for the first 20 years better, and now it's become terrible again. I think this at the moment is worse than ever.
That's quite a statement coming from you.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, and at the time, in our time, people could still deny they don't know about it. But now you see the atrocities in your own living room. So, you know, there's no denying what is happening.
Important for people just to keep calling attention to these things and talking about things and demanding some sort of action?
Well, you know, I don't think it's individual people. I think, so, you know, there's a lot of goodwill. There's a lot of people who try to do change things. But I think it's governments who just keep us, just do what they want.
Okay.
And it is power and money. And, you know, I don't think it's any individual who really wants to live in a war and have it possibly to be killed and your family being killed. Who wants that?
Ms. Schloss, it's a tremendous honor talking to you. Thank you for taking time to chat with us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Eva Schloss will appear on behalf of the Chabad Jewish Center of Wyoming next Thursday night at 7. Governor Mead will proclaim the day Wyoming Tolerance Day.
Coming up, we will talk about mental health and hear from an interesting artist. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Mental health, it's a topic that can be hard to talk about. So the National Council for Behavioral Health has taken a cue from successful CPR and first aid programs and designed a similar training to help everyday citizens know how to respond in a mental health crisis. Rebecca Huntington has more.
You guys can do, you can team up on this, or you can do individual.
A half dozen Jackson community members are gathered in a classroom in the basement of St. John's Medical Center.
About 30 seconds.
Their instructor, Adam Williamson, has handed out poster-sized paper and markers and asked them to draw a picture of anxiety.
This is just my very simple representation of a very frayed and harried person. So those are my lack of drawing skills.
Tanya Mark runs a company that coaches clients in wellness and nutrition. She decided to take this 8-hour training after getting a not-so-subtle hint from one of her clients, who she was helping with weight loss.
And he happened to pull out a booklet of information on the community counseling center, and he specifically opened it up to one page.
That one page described mental health first aid, a program that teaches people how to identify, understand, and respond to signs of mental illness. Mark is now one of about 100 people in Jackson and the surrounding area to participate in the program, offered through the Jackson Hole Community Counseling Center. Center Executive Director Deidre Ashley says the program is spotlighting a problem that's a lot more common than people realize.
1 in 4 people are dealing with some sort of mental health issues, so it's very common. A lot of people will not seek services because of the stigma that's attached to it.
By modeling the training after CPR and first aid, Ashley says the program aims to make average people feel more comfortable when dealing with mental illness.
It's not a clinical training, so it's not expecting people to handle things that they're not equipped for. It's really just to give you that basic awareness of what you're seeing and sort of how to help them get to where they need to go.
And that, Ashley says, can promote early detection and intervention, which can avoid a bigger crisis later. In Wyoming, counseling centers have pooled resources to train instructors who are now training citizens statewide.
Ooh, no, that one's not right.
It doesn't make sense.
No, and this would be last.
So far, some 20 instructors have been trained, and that included counselor and therapist Adam Williamson, who's teaching this class.
But when you look at schizophrenia, say a neighbor gets diagnosed with schizophrenia, are you, you know, making the cast rules? Are you offering to babysit their kids while they go to their doctor's appointment?
It's a little frightening.
That's right.
Williamson is passionate about correcting misperceptions. In class, for example, he stresses that mental illnesses such as depression and anxiety disorders can be just as or more disabling than physical diseases, such as diabetes. He says the training also opens up a healthy discussion about psychosis.
One of the reasons why there's a stigma is because, in my mind, the media oftentimes will portray psychosis as being very dangerous or something that we want to avoid or stay away from or something that we can't help with.
He wants to make it clear that citizens can help. Williamson has trained mostly professionals who may encounter a mental health crisis on the job. But participant Amy Russian says she took the class simply as a community member, interested in learning more about the topic.
I think this course would be helpful for anyone, whether you're just a general interest participant or you have a professional reason to do so.
One of the biggest things that I did learn today is to be able to listen.
That's participant Tanya Mark, who says that for her, the training offered a rare opportunity to have a conversation about an often hidden subject. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Huntington in Jackson.
It was the Protestant reformer Martin Luther who proposed that we are simultaneously saints and sinners. Jackson artist Aaron Wallace is illustrating that idea by placing drug dealers and gang leaders in the context of Christian iconography, putting halos around criminals' heads. The newest collection of illuminated manuscripts in his Street Bible series opens August 29th at the Rose and the Pink Garter Theater in Jackson. Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer spoke with Wallace about the work and how hip-hop influenced the artist's view of the world.
I felt there was a lot of similarities between the early Christian church, the apostles, how they were kind of persecuted by the Roman political authority, and how drug dealers and other people, criminals, are kind of persecuted by the political authority in America, our current class structure, singles people like that out through the criminal justice system. So I kind of felt that there was also this element of like martyrdom and persecution, especially with like rappers that end up getting killed and murdered, you know, that was worth exploring.
And putting these people in the context of illuminated manuscripts and iconography raises this question of who is good and who is moral, because you're often highlighting in the text that accompanies these the systems of oppression that they're caught in. So you have a guy, Stanley Tookie Williams, who talks about how he was abused by guards in prison. And so the whole moral structure is now in question.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of moral subjectivity in the criminal justice system. I think if you ask most people, at least most middle class or affluent white people, they have this idea that the criminal justice system kind of represents what's right and what's moral, and that we have kind of laws to, you know, uphold what's right and what's moral. And, you know, I kind of take a little more of, I guess, maybe a Marxist view that laws are kind of created to uphold the class structure, and that laws aren't necessarily based on what's moral or what's right, especially, yeah, like how Tukey Williams was tortured for 2 years, drugged and tortured in the LA County jail by sheriff's deputies, you know, the people who are supposedly upholding the law.
Another interesting case is Felix Mitchell Jr. He was an Oakland drug kingpin and was apparently much beloved in his community.
You know, Mitchell ran the San Antonio Village housing projects, essentially controlled the neighborhood. He built basketball courts, you know, he ran a program to feed people. He bought groceries for people. He paid people's rent when they couldn't make their rent, you know. So he was really, you know, regarded as with a lot of respect in the community as like a philanthropist and a person who really cared about the people that society had forgotten.
But helping people while also ruining other people's lives. I mean, in the case of Mitchell, he's selling $800,000 worth of drugs in a week.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. But I feel like, again, that brings us to an area of moral subjectivity where perhaps Freeway Rick Ross is a better way to example of illustrating it. Freeway Rick Ross was buying his cocaine from Daniello Blandone, who was a CIA informant. And Daniello was essentially trafficking Oliver North's cocaine in the Iran-Contra scandal. So, you know, Freeway Rick Ross was getting his cocaine from the United States government, and he rose to become the biggest drug dealer on the West Coast. And he never could have done it without the complicity of the CIA.
Aaron Wallace, the images that you're creating in this print series, The Street Bible, draw on Christian iconography. And you say in your biography on your website that you are the reluctant product of an evangelical Christian upbringing. Does that play any role in choosing this style of art?
Oh, I feel it plays a huge role. My dad works for Pat Robertson, the Christian televangelist who ran the 700 Club through most of the 80s. And, you know, I grew up in this very right-wing evangelical family. So, you know, I started listening to rap music in junior high school, you know, and hip-hop was kind of one of my first, you know, ways that I got introduced to the real world, or the world outside what I was allowed to see and listen to in the church. Hip-hop was really responsible for me questioning a lot of the values that I kind of had beat into me as a kid. You know, I still reference, I feel, that kind of Christian past in the work. The work is, you know, on my part, kind of an attempt to identify and just deal with this incredibly repressed Christian childhood I had, and, you know, kind of insert something into that canon of Christian iconography that the people who originally created that type of art would have never imagined.
And how did your family react to you listening to hip-hop in junior high?
They found my tapes and they threw them out. They destroyed them all. We would have these long conversations about the kind of subversive moral values and sexual promiscuity that black culture promotes, and, you know, all these other sort of things, and just drug use and all of these other sort of things, even though I had no idea what drugs were at that time.
So how do they respond to your work, The Street Bible?
I think that they'd probably prefer I was making impressionist paintings or something. But I think that if, you know, you really got down to it, they probably wouldn't approve of a lot of the subject matter or the fact that I'm, you know, essentially deifying drug dealers and gang leaders and rappers in the work.
Who do you think needs to see this art?
I think that Jackson is actually a good place to be making art like this, because I think that Jackson's a very affluent, upper-class white community. I feel that it's art that needs to be seen by a lot of people, because it addresses these core issues of class inequality and, you know, social status that are becoming so relevant in our society today.
The exhibit Street Bible 2 opens August 29th at the Rose and the Pink Garter Theater in Jackson. Aaron Wallace, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, yeah, thank you very much.
You can see examples of the exhibit at wyomingpublicmedia.org. This summer, a nature conservancy program called LEAF offered urban high schoolers the chance to live and work in the shadow of Heart Mountain north of Cody. The hope is to get the kids to love Wyoming so much that they'll come back for its colleges and its jobs in conservation. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards has more.
Oh, here go one. Just about to miss it.
Floppy sun hats float over waist-deep grasses along a lush irrigation ditch. The cliffs of Heart Mountain loom above. Kiaria Mack and Jaclyn Moore wear leather work gloves and carry serious-looking clippers and plastic bags. They are hunting the hillside for hound's tongue, an invasive plant species. Mac calls it vicious.
They have a little purplish color to it. So what you do is you have to cut from the bottom. You can't cut where the seeds are because it gets stuck to your clothes. And if it goes back into the ground, it grows again. So you have to make sure you get to a certain spot. And
she snips off a lanky plant with dark, spinachy-looking leaves and stuffs it into her garbage bag. What do they have against this innocuous-looking plant?
It shuts down your liver functions, well, the animal's liver functions when they eat it, so they die, so it's not really good, and it's invasive. So basically it takes nutrients that the native plants need.
That's Alicia Griffin, another intern awarded a competitive spot in a paid work-study program through the Nature Conservancy. The program is called LEAF. Carrie Peters is the program's coordinator.
The LEAF program is an internal conservancy program and stands for Leaders in Environmental Action for the Future.
Peter says the aim of the program is to transplant urban kids into wild places like Heart Mountain Ranch. But it's not a guest ranch. They do real work, like removing barbed wire from wildlife migration routes or building trails. To get in, these students have to attend a Nature Conservancy-approved high school, which means they have a conservation curriculum. But that's not all.
We had to fill out an application, 3 essays, and then they called us, letting us know that we had an interview, and it was about 24 of us that they chose.
And so what do you think that it was that you all had in common that set you apart?
We like adventure.
This year's group is from Arabia Mountain High in Atlanta, Georgia, and they're all aspiring doctors and engineers. But Griffin admits her plans are still forming.
I was either going to do graphic art or some type of science, and I think I'm kind of leaning towards wildlife biology because you get to do this.
And Peter says that's the point of the program, to get kids into conservation when they're deciding their futures.
When they do decide to go to college and they hit the job market and stuff, they had this experience here in Wyoming, like, oh, yeah, you know, that was really cool what we did there, that stewardship stuff we did on Heart Mountain Ranch. And maybe I'd be interested in, you know, looking for a job to do something similar like that.
Peter says the idea is to help them fall in love with place, with a capital P. For this year's crop, the program succeeded in spades.
We don't get breezes in Georgia. It's just like, get off the plane. So the wind was so nice. I think that was the first thing I liked about it, was the wind. And then I noticed the mountains and everything. But I think the wind drew me in.
The air.
At the end of the day, the interns cart their heavy bags full of hound's tongue back to the truck and heap them high to burn back at the ranch. Nearby, a few cattle are grazing. The students might like adventure, but when it comes to cows...
Alicia, don't you dare. Alicia, shut up. Look, they're looking at you, too. Stop playing games.
And sometimes they can jump across the wires.
Keep playing. They come right across from here. We're leaving you right
and
here.
And they can't walk the wires.
What's a cow going to do to me? Push you down the hills on their back.
They might be on the brink of making bright futures in conservation careers far from home, but for now, they're still so just fun. Kids. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
We tell it.
Coming up, we will have a preview of the Wyoming Cowboys football team and much, much more. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces. I'm Bob Back.
And I'm Melody Edwards. The Wyoming Cowboys football season fell apart last year. The Cowboys finished with 5 wins and 7 losses, but lost 5 of their last 6 games. After the season ended, the Cowboys also lost their coach and watched their starting quarterback and his backup leave the team. New coach Craig Bohl had a lot of success coaching at North Dakota State, where he won 3 national championships in a division below Wyoming. The question is whether he and his coaching staff can turn things around in Laramie. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
Good.
Down like that way, you've got a race, right?
It's a sunny day in August as the Wyoming Cowboys run through drills with the full offense playing against the full defense. The new coaching staff has changed everything about how the team plays and practices. On defense, the main focus is to help the unit simply play better. Wyoming's defense was dreadful last year, giving up over 48 points per game in 5 of its last 6 games. New defensive coordinator Steve Stannard has had a lot of success as a defensive coach over the years, and he's looking forward to watching the Cowboys improve.
We constantly talk about where our expectations are and our practice habits and what we expect from a finish and an effort level. And we hold that bar up there, and every day we're grinding them to keep working towards that bar.
Stannard says the team didn't always play hard for 4 quarters in the past and gave up too many big plays. Defensive back Blair Byrne says the coaches insist that every player run to the ball.
So, you know, if we have everybody flying to the ball and everyone's, you know, throwing their heads in there and, you know, trying to get in on tackles and ball carries and receivers and things like that, they're going to be scared to catch the ball and scared to run the ball. So
Byrne says the change has been noticeable. On offense, the biggest change is that record-setting quarterback Brett Smith is no longer with the Cowboys, and the starting job falls to backup Colby Kirkegaard, who's had limited playing time in the past. Head coach Craig Bohl said in the spring that Kirkegaard would need to make a lot of progress, and apparently that's happened. Last year's leading receiver Dominic Rufran has been impressed.
You can't deny the doubt that everybody had at the beginning of the year. I mean, personally, myself, I had doubt as well. But now, from what I've seen in the spring, what I've seen in the summer, what I've seen in the fall, I could be more than pleased with the job that Kobe's doing as a quarterback. He's doing a fantastic job leading the offense. He's doing a fantastic job making the throws.
His offensive coordinator, Brent Vegan, says the Kirkegaard made tremendous progress over the summer, and he's now leading the team.
I think there's a real sense of urgency. This is his opportunity, really his one and only that he's had in his career here. And it's also an understanding. And you go through and you work as hard as he did, and the team, the offense the team did this summer, you learn things much better, and you know what you're doing.
Kirkegaard admits that his confidence has grown along with his understanding of the offense. Wyoming's old offense was known as a spread, where the quarterback did a lot of running and throwing. The new Wyoming offense resembles what most NFL teams play, with the quarterback closer to the ball and running backs behind him. Kirkegaard says that better suits his talents.
I think it distributes the weight of the offense more evenly across the board. We've got so many weapons we can use, whether it be some of our running backs, our tight ends, our fullback, our receivers. So there's just a lot of elements that you use in it.
Wyoming's offense should put points on the board, but the work in progress is the offensive line. Coach Vegan says they want the line to be more aggressive than it's been in the past. He says that change of mentality is coming along slowly.
It was such a quick get rid of it scheme here in so many cases that they didn't have to pass block really either. So it's not just about our physical nature in the run game. It's about guys having to maintain and become better pass blockers.
Vegan says they are getting better, but they still have not settled on starters. The new-look Cowboys open the season in Laramie on August 30th against Montana. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
For the last 2 weeks, Moscow Ballet soloist Olga Aru has been teaching ballet masterclasses at studios in Gillette and Casper. She lives in Italy, but Aru was born in Ukraine, a disputed part of the country that's seen intense fighting. Her international touring has brought her close to conflict as well. She was performing in Cairo when the 2011 Egyptian Revolution erupted. Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard sat down with her and asked her about her experiences.
I was there. I just started my season. It was my first season in Cairo National Opera House. And the life there was beautiful. I mean, it was so different from Europe, Northern Africa, different language, different culture. And I was really enjoying that time. And unfortunately, that revolution happened, and it was not possible to stay there any longer. But I was there, and I saw all these clashes. I was actually living on the Shahr el Tahrir, which was about 10-15 minutes walk to Maidan el Tahrir, where everything happened.
And that's Tahrir Square.
Tahrir Square, yeah. I'm very grateful to Egyptian people. They tried to protect us very much. And they helped us with food, with transportation, apartments, whatever they could. And I survived because of them.
Now you're from Donetsk.
I was born there, and I graduated in Kyiv. I moved to Kyiv, to the capital.
How did it feel to see the fighting break out in eastern Ukraine?
Well, you know, the only feeling that I have is, you know, we should all stay in peace, and people should not die. That's my point.
How does dancing influence your view of the world and interacting with all these different cultures?
Actually, it feels so unique that I'm able to see different cultures, to travel, to see how people live in different countries. Art makes us united. You know, art has no language. Dance, music, sculpture, painting. You shouldn't speak any language to understand it.
What do you try and teach to your students when you're teaching master classes like this?
Well, when I teach my master classes, first of all, I try to teach them to remember the combinations. And then going from there, their confidence, their stage presence, their attitude when they dance. They should try to perform, you know, not only do certain choreography that I'm teaching them to do.
There's a lot of unrest right now in the world, and I feel like you've obviously sort of thought about that a lot. So what do you think it means to have dance, even in times of war?
That's a great question, and it just made me think of the Second World War and how people were still performing. You know, Perm Ballet Theater, Bolshoi Ballet Theater, they've been evacuated, and they've been performing in front of the soldiers. And I think that dance itself, it heals. So it has this beautiful ability to heal the soul, and same as soul, it can heal the body. I think in any time, in any country, it would bring its message of healing.
Olga Aru will return to Gillette and Casper in November to perform The Great Russian Nutcracker with the Moscow Ballet. The company has dedicated this year's North American tour to world peace, and instead of a land of sweets, the production will have a land of peace and harmony.
Thanks for listening to our show today. If you'd like to hear the program or individual segments, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just simply click on Open Spaces. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We also invite you to become a fan of our Wyoming Public Radio News Facebook page, and you can follow all of our reporters on Twitter.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.